Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Scary movie love for scary movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited for this episode because I get to talk about a movie that I just saw for the very first time. A brand new movie to me. We're going to be talking about Silent Hill. And for this very special episode, I am joined by Rob DiCristino.
Sorry, Patrick, I can't hear you. I am trapped in an alternate dimension.
Oh, we'll get there. We will get there. Thank you, everybody, who continues to participate in the Scary Movie Challenge. Every day that you watch a horror movie in October, please go to fthismovie.com and write a 7-word review of said movie. You'll see a bunch if you don't know how to do it. There are plenty of examples there for you. There's a tab up at the top of the page that says Scary Movie Challenge. Just click on that. It'll take you to the most recent post, and you can come up with your 7-word review. We like to read some reviews on each episode. Some are our favorites. Some are the ones we think are the best. Obviously, we can't read them all, even though we would like to. But let's kick it off by reading some of our 7-word reviews. Rob, I will let you go first.
Brian Sager on Society. I met my wife the same way.
Paul Newman, 1989, Jugface. Rural community finds solution to healthcare problem.
I wrote that one down too. Matthew B., Tales from the Hood. Hey, Clarence, can you go a little bigger?
Our very own Eric Asperschlager of Malevolent, the new Netflix movie. Hey, meddling kids, could you meddle faster?
Our own Adam Risky, an American Werewolf in Paris. Del Paxton, he werewolf with Larry Talbot. I wanted that one because it was, That Thing You Do reference.
Yeah. Our friend Miko Vinica, who is taking one for the team and counting the 7-word reviews every day and posting the latest count to Twitter. So thank you again, Miko. You're awesome. He says of Nightmare Sisters, I might accidentally wear out the Blu-ray.
Thank you, Miko. Your service is invaluable. Mm-hmm. Jeremy Wickett, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. Let me make sure I read this carefully. Orange, blood, sugar, Atkins, stash, sex magic.
Brian Sager of The Dead Zone. Johnny, fuckhead that he is, goes rogue.
DTE on Hereditary. More like Gabriel Byrne, am I right?
That's an excellent one. Cullen of Black Sabbath. Something about this film was word-a-lacking.
I have to read this one because it's a Dan Harmon reference. Monster House. I'm sorry, Stuart Gordon on Monster House. From those that brought you Pringles dick. And that joke makes sense if you listen to the Harmontown podcast.
It did not make sense to me, so this explains so much. Shane Golden of Revenge. Probably not getting the rental deposit back.
TJ Mackey 432, Tales of Halloween. More Alex Esso, please and thank you.
Yes. Oh, my gosh, yes. Casey Doran of Child's Play, Academy Award winner for Best Expository Mural.
Andy Bishop, Battle Royale. This new apple choker doesn't look safe.
Ross of Alien 3, it's We'll Fix It in Post-Horror.
Our own Michael Pomero, who is, of course, the MVP every friggin' year, and it pisses me off. Terrifier. I wish I had watched something else.
Told him to watch something else. I straight up said, watch something else. Anyway, The Shape, Dawn of the Dead. For this mall, every day is Black Friday.
Cullen on Abominable. Calling a Sasquatch a Yeti is abominable.
Greg Anderson of Death Spa. Watch as 80s hard bodies become hard body parts.
Yeah, that one too. All right, Louis Viljon, sorry, buddy. Possession. Got to read this one carefully too. Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, Polish Creature Feature.
Ryan Byam, I have to read this against my better judgment, but my own opinions on this matter, but it's maybe the best one I've seen this month, even though it hurts my heart.
I know
what's
coming.
Poltergeist. Toby or not Toby? That's the question.
It might be the best one, and I copied and pasted it into my document. I was like, I'm not going to read this. I'm not going to do that to Patrick.
Well,
but
thank you.
I'm glad you read it, because
it's too good to be ignored.
And good on you for, you know, setting aside your feelings and acknowledging it. Frank Levesque, knock knock. There's no such thing as free pizza.
Tad Ghostel, the witch who came from the sea. More severed penises than my wedding night.
John Hillman, Frankenstein, 1931. Yeah, use the whip. That'll calm him down.
This is my last one. John Kervan for Man's Best Friend. Like Cujo on Ambien, a mastiff yawn.
I have a couple more. Aaron Keith, 47 meters down. Woman needs cheering up. Let down instead. Mm. Patrick McAllister on The Shining. Room service, moisturizer for room 237, please. Mm-hmm. Two more. The Blair Witch Project, Reed Strickland. Good project, but turned in late. Zero. And lastly, it's David Lynch reference. I had to bring it up. Derek Smith, Twin Peaks Firewalk with Me. Cream corn is just Twin Peaks midichlorians. And I absolutely agree with him on that.
All right. Well, please keep the 7-word reviews coming. Obviously, we love them, and we enjoy reading them on the show. So keep them coming. We're doing great. Rob, have you seen anything scary lately?
I really have. I don't know about you, buddy, but I've had a great scary movie month so far.
Well, one of us has.
I there's this thing, you know, when I first started, I was always saying that I wasn't a horror person, and I always wanted to put that out there, and it wasn't so much like that I don't like horror movies. It's just I just have so much respect for the horror community that, like, you know, like I'm a fan of things, and I always hate when people claim, you know, like I know it's like kind of bullshit gatekeeping, but like I don't want to come off and say, oh yeah, I love horror if I don't know anything about it. But obviously, you know, the last 2 years I've really just immersed myself in it, and most of the movie people I talk to are horror movie people, and I think I've just gotten to this point where I don't say I'm not a horror person anymore. Like it's just a thing where I'm like, no, I know enough about it now, and I have enough experience with it where I feel better, you know, being able to say that. I don't have that imposter syndrome anymore and stuff. So this year for Scary Movie Month, you know, rather than setting myself up with this like syllabus, you know, I'm alternating back and forth between something new, something old, you know, and it's gone really well so far. I've been able to revisit stuff that I like, and also so far anyway, all the new stuff that I watch for the most part has been really fun. So I'm having a really good month so far, actually.
That's outstanding.
But I'll just talk quickly about a couple here. I guess kind of pseudo inspired by Death Spa, I checked out Killer Workout, and my only comment for Killer Workout is David A. Pryor is a huge perv, but that's okay. One of the movies on my list.
By the way, do you know the original title for Killer Workout?
Aerobicide.
Just aerobicide.
Aerobicide. Yes. Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Like, yeah. How did you not? Did they think maybe it wouldn't translate, or
people wouldn't know how to pronounce it? Who knows?
That's probably.
Killer Workout. I mean, it's fine, but Aerobicide is such a better title.
That's so much better. So one of the movies on my list that I wrote with Adam was The Lords of Salem, which I watched. And, you know, my notes for that, I just kind of wrote down that it looks beautiful and it has a lot of fun with a lot of cool mythology. And you're either in for a Rob Zombie movie or you're not. And I think that's the case. And I'm generally in for Rob Zombie movies. I really like the Sherry Moon Zombie performance in this. And I like it a lot. I want to watch it again so I can really kind of digest it a little bit more, because there's a lot there, but I really enjoyed watching it.
I'm a big fan of that movie. I think I would be a 10% bigger fan of that movie, which, you know, could put me close to 100%, if not for the terrible DJ scenes.
I did not like them either.
It's very strange. It's as though Rob Zombie has never heard an actual morning show. Or I don't even know if it's a morning show. It's structured like one, but actually they seem to be broadcasting at night. Or if he's only heard parodies of those and then thinks that's what it is. It's bananas that it is so clumsy and cliched and terrible.
And also, like, the other problem with that is are the Ken Furry character and stuff, like, are they coded as like cool? Like, is the idea that, like, you know, they're having fun and we're supposed to look up to the guys and they're funny, or are they kind of, you know, can't be weirdos like you said? But yeah, either way, that doesn't feel lived in enough. And I guess you would think, you know, as a musician, Rob Zombie's probably set in on a bunch of those shows, you know, promoting music and stuff. So it'd be weird that wouldn't feel right. But yeah, I agree with you. It's kind of strange.
Yeah.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Sorry. Overall, I love the movie. I love looking at it. It's one of those, you know, kind of every frame a painting kind of movies where you're like, that's beautiful. That's beautiful too.
Yeah.
The other one I'll talk about real quick, Carnival of Souls. I saw Carnival of Souls for the first time.
Very nice.
Simple, effective. I love the sort of industrial film kind of ethos to it. It reminded me of Romero, obviously. I like the director, Herc Harvey, is how you say his name? Cameos as the kind of the villain, the man, as he's credited. Truly creepy. Reminded me a lot of... it reminded me a lot of this poll will be for some people, not others, but The Gentleman from Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Sure.
I saw a lot of influence there, probably. I would be very surprised if those guys hadn't seen Carnival of Souls. But that one was really cool, and that's a really good example of a movie that's, you know, like the kind of movies that I've been really appreciating this Scary Movie Month, where they're not the obvious thing, but they're also not, you know, I don't have to worry so much about quality, you know, like I know this is going to be good going into it.
Yeah. What is the best new thing you've seen this month so far?
The best new thing to me that I've liked the most is Nina Forever.
Oh, okay. Very cool.
Yeah, I was gonna come to that one. Yeah, Nina Forever.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. No, I didn't mean it like that. I was saving it for the end, but we'll go to it now. Yeah. Nina Forever is definitely my favorite. Adam told me, he said to me, he's like, yeah, it's like Chasing Amy kind of vibe to it, and he's totally right. You know, we can bicker back and forth about whether or not it's a horror movie at all, but it's so up my alley. Like, that movie is so my jam. I really liked it a lot. I love what it was doing. Abigail Hardingham is, oh my.
Which character is she?
She's the lead.
Okay, yes.
She's not Nina. She's the...
correct, yes. Yeah. That is the correct response.
Yes, although Fiona O'Shaughnessy, who plays Nina, is wonderful too. You mentioned, I went back and read your review afterwards, you mentioned that it runs along for the first hour or so, and then it tries to kind of be this other thing near the end that doesn't quite work as well without spoiling anything. And I sort of agree with that, but I like the effort. Like, I like that it's a really well-directed movie. It's dealing with, you know, we talk about horror as allegory and stuff, and I just love that. I love the whole idea of the movie about, you know, moving on and the other person, you know, kind of trying to help move on, but it's, you know, for all the reasons why it's difficult and stuff. It's really, really, really great. I really loved it a lot. I mean, it wasn't on my radar at all. I know I must have read your review of it, but, you know, it wasn't on my radar until you and Rob G were talking about it sort of in passing a couple weeks ago.
Is that on Shudder still?
I don't know. I bought it on, or I rented it on the iTunes.
Okay. Very cool.
Although, speaking of which, I don't want to bring this up with you. This is a Dread Central Presents release, right?
Correct. It's a double feature Blu-ray release with Imitation Girl, which is also a really cool movie.
And I was thinking about that because I also am a big fan of Imitation Girl, too. Yeah. And I wanted to ask you, because you talked about it with Rob when he was on the show, but I wanted to ask you now, how do you feel about his idea of the reversible covers? Because I was trying to think about it when I was thinking about, oh, I'm definitely going to pick up the Dread Central Blu-ray of this because I like both those movies. And I was thinking to myself, well, which one am I going to feature more prominently on the front? And right now I'm all high on Nina Forever, but like, I also like Imitation Girl. How do you, as a collector, how do you feel about that idea?
I think it's great. I think it doesn't hurt anything, certainly, because it just gives you options. I'm a big enough weirdo that I will like always feel compelled to just keep it on however it arrives, you know, like, oh, this is the one that they chose to put in the front, so this is the one I'm going to keep it on.
Got it.
Which is stupid, right? But yeah, the freedom to change it up if you want, I think it's cool.
Yeah. So when you get Scream Factory, do you flip away from the art, or do you leave it on the front?
I generally leave it on the front. There are some exceptions. And sometimes I'm sort of forced to leave it on the front. This is not, this is like not an actual problem that I'm complaining about, but some of my Scream Factory discs were sent to me by Scream Factory to review. And when they do that, they punch a hole through the UPC. Well, when you reverse the cover, it's not through the UPC. It's through usually like the title. It's kind of in the upper right hand corner. So in some instances, I'm sort of locked into using their art, but for the most part, I just leave it. I don't know if I have any at this point that I have reversed.
Fair enough. It's just interesting the way that we have these little quirks as collectors. So
right.
I was all day today, I was thinking about it. Like, I was like doing these imaginary double features in my head and thinking like, which one would I have on the front? But either way, I'm going to pick up the disc because I'm definitely going to go back to Nina Forever multiple times because it's so up my alley.
That's great.
Last thing I'll mention real quick. I told you and Adam earlier this month at my kind of scary movie month present myself was I finally picked up the Scream Factory Halloween set, only to find out that the Halloween 6 producer's cut wasn't in there. So as homage to our friend Anya Novak, I had to make sure that I bought the producer's cut separate. So I watched that for the first time.
Yeah.
I don't know where you are on that one, but I really like it. I actually really like the way like the cult stuff is done. It's not like something I need, and I don't really agree with like all the interpretation of like the Michael Myers legend and all that, and or the reinterpretation of it. But like at that point, it's part six, and it's kind of okay to start messing around. I can divorce it from my experience with the first movie and stuff like that. So I was kind of watching it the other night and thinking to myself, like, this is weird and goofy and fun, and I'm into it. So
I have yet to watch it.
Okay.
Because I know that I have to watch both of them back to back. Like, I have to watch the theatrical cut just so I can know what's different in the producer's cut. And it's funny that you bring it up, because just this morning I was listening to the latest episode of We Need to Talk About Horror from the guys at DestroyTheBrain.com. And they did an episode on Halloween 4, 5, and 6, like the Thorn trilogy. And their conversation about 6 made me want to revisit it. And then it also happened to pop up today on AMC, you know, started their Fear Fest. And of course, they run a few Halloween movies endlessly. And so I caught a few minutes of 6. So my plan at some point this week is to watch the theatrical cut and then the producer's cut.
Yeah, I don't remember, you know, I only saw the theatrical cut for the first time last year, and I remember very little about it. But I definitely walked away from the producer's cut thinking, you know, I was very surprised at like, oh, this movie, you know, they didn't make this one. They released something else, you know. So
what else is not in that Halloween box? Because they issued two. Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, they issued two early on. There was like the 15-disc one and the 10-disc one.
So mine is the 10-disc one.
Right.
But I think all of the docs and stuff that were included, allegedly, according to the back of the box, are still included. I'm in no way an authority on this, so sure. I could be totally wrong. But I remember looking at the box when I bought it, and it had most of the like feature-length documentaries. I think one of the Rob Zombie documentaries might not be on there. I don't know how many. Yeah, because the one disc was like 15. The only thing I know for sure that's absent is the producer's cut of 6, which I don't know why they got rid of it. I'm not sure what the deal was there.
Well, when they first announced it, you know, they made it sound like this is the only way to get the producer's cut, which was a big reason why I went with the 15 disc instead of the 10. And the 15 disc one is sort of long out of print and I think very expensive if you try to buy it. But so I was like, oh, I got to get this one. It's the only way I'll get the producer's cut. And then inside of a year, it was like, here's the producer's cut on Blu-ray for $6 or something.
I think I paid $4.
For it's, yeah. It's bananas. So, you know, really doing the 10 disc and then the $4 producer's cut is probably the way to go.
Yeah, so it worked out. But yeah, so I've been, speaking of movies that's been revisiting, I've been chasing a new horror movie with like a Halloween sequel, you know, every couple nights and stuff.
Nice.
So that's been nice.
Nice, very nice. I've only watched 4 and 5 thus far. In terms,
I think,
of
I so yeah. I mean, four is fun. Dwight H. Little, he's your boy.
That's right.
Five, I have no use for. But 6, I like a lot of 6. So let me know when you watch the producer's cut of 6, because I'd be curious.
I absolutely will. I'm excited about it. On the last episode, I think it was the Practical Magic episode, I brought up a Netflix original or a Netflix pickup called Truth or Dare, directed by Nick Simon. And I said, it's actually not bad and worth a watch. So then I went ahead and went over to the Redbox, your home base, and I rented Blumhouse's Truth or Dare, which is, I think renting it from a Redbox is the only way it should be seen. There are certain movies like that. And I got to say, the Netflix one is way better. This one obviously was made for more money, has a more recognizable actor because the lead girl in it is like somebody from Pretty Little Liars, maybe. She's like somebody. I recognized her. But the movie itself is just not great. They follow kind of similar patterns, but this one makes choices that I'm not into. The characters were kind of garbage. And I know Adam had kind of warned me that there was a crazy twist, that it got kind of weird by the end. And there absolutely is a crazy twist, but it almost has nothing. It has no bearing on the story, really. It doesn't actually change anything or affect any of the plot going forward. It's just, oh, here's a piece of information that's bananas. Let's carry on. And it reminded me a little bit of, I don't know how to say this without spoiling, human cloning in Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. Like, here's a crazy bit of information, and let's move on, as though that didn't happen. So yeah, I did not care for Blumhouse's Truth or Dare.
I remember I definitely watched it also out of the red box, of course. I think I'm, without spoiling anything, I think I'm aware of what you're talking about, the twist there. And yeah, it is kind of like a, okay.
What a weird development to then have no bearing on the story.
Yeah. I have not seen the other Truth or Dare, though, although I'm looking at it right now and the poster looks more exciting.
It's, again, it's not great, but I put it on sort of expecting the worst, and the longer it went on, the more I was like, oh, this actually isn't bad. And by the end, I was kind of into it, which I cannot say of Blumhouse's Truth or Dare.
I think you're talking about Lucy Hale?
That's the name, yeah.
There you go. Got your back, buddy.
Lucy Hale, America's favorite. I also watched another Netflix premiere that just showed up last Friday, and that is Apostle, the new movie from Gareth Evans, the director of The Raid and The Raid 2. I have known about this movie for a while. I know it's played some festivals. I think Ryan Turek talked about it on a recent Shockwaves. Dan Stevens stars as a guy who goes to this remote island, I think it's an island, to rescue his sister who has fallen in with this cult led by Michael Sheen. And I know when Ryan Turek talked about it, I think he mentioned The Wicker Man. It is very sort of Wicker Man-ish. It's not a bad movie, but I have to say, coming from Gareth Evans, I thought it was kind of a disappointment. He's obviously trying to do something a little bit different because, you know, he directed along with, he and Timo Jahanto directed the middle segment in VHS 2, which for me is like, maybe the 20 best minutes of horror of the last like 30 years. I just think, do you know the one I'm talking about?
I'm familiar with it. I haven't seen it though.
Oh my gosh. Just watch that segment. You can skip the rest of VHS 2, but watch.
Okay.
It will blow your mind. It is so great. So I was like, well, clearly Gareth Evans can do horror. And so I was really looking forward to this. It's well directed. It looks good. There are certainly some moments where, you know, his movies are known for being kind of violent. And he definitely leans into that at times. It's not a particularly bloody movie, but when it is, it's pretty hardcore. But it just never really went anywhere than where I expected it to go. And I just had a hard time kind of really getting into it. You know, it's like, well, that was kind of a good version of what it wants to be. Maybe part of it is that it's a type of horror that I'm not totally into. Although I don't know if that's true because I just like last week was talking about how much I liked Blood on Satan's Claw. So I don't know. You should absolutely check it out. Like, I think it's worth seeing just because of who made it. But I did feel a little bit let down.
So the only metric that matters here, Patrick, is mark on or mark off?
Oh, gosh. I mean, mark on.
Okay.
Yeah.
I also want to throw out there, I was just scrolling through the IMDb while you were talking, and there's an actor on the cast list named Mark Lewis Jones.
Interesting.
Any relation, do you think?
Interesting.
Mark Lewis Jones plays Quinn. And Quinn's real small.
Oh, yeah, exactly. He was thinking the whole movie about a tiny apostle. Anyway, Mark Jones, I have a feeling, is going to make a pretty big appearance in a podcast towards the end of the month. I think it's worth seeing when you said mark on or mark off. It's a mark on because it's on Netflix. Like, I think if it was playing in theaters, I wouldn't tell people to go see it.
Right.
But it's very easy to watch and I think worth watching. I don't have a ton of other like good new stuff. I've been rewatching the Hatchet movies in reverse. So I started with Victor Crowley and I wrote a thing about Victor Crowley and then I was like, well, I feel like watching the other movies, but I went 3-2 and I haven't come back to one yet. But they're enjoyable. They're very easy to put on, like, while I'm writing, you know, and just have on in the background. I still feel bad saying this, but 3 is still my least favorite of all of them. It looks really good. It feels bigger than the other movies, and it's supposed to, you know, it's sort of the big finish because it was conceived as a trilogy, and it's the only one that Adam Green did not direct. So it has a little bit of a different feel, and it definitely feels bigger, but it's like the one that I just am kind of the least into in terms of the trilogy. I have you seen any of them? I don't even know.
I have not, actually. Okay. I was going to think about it. But I was watching your, because I think a lot of us are watching the 7-word reviews to try to figure out what this year's show is going to be.
Oh, interesting.
This year's franchise show is going to be. So I noticed that. I noticed you were watching him in reverse. I was like, that's odd. I wonder what he's doing there. But no, I have not, unfortunately, seen any of them yet. So I'm adding that to the list.
They are fun. They're not for everybody, you know. And there are some people who think they're garbage, and then there's some people who like their favorite movies, and I'm somewhere in between. I like them a lot, but you know, it's not a hill that I would die on.
So what you're saying is the Hatchet movies are not the franchise podcast this year.
I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying that I have been watching them in reverse. All right, let's talk about Silent Hill. Based on a video game, a series of video games. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
That started in like 99.
So the first Silent Hill is 99. The movie is primarily based on the first and second games. Silent Hill 1 is 99. Silent Hill 2 is 2001.
Okay. All right. The movie comes out in 2006. You wrote a piece about it last Scary Movie Month, yes?
I did. Yes.
And it didn't make a ton of sense to me when I read it last year because I had not seen the movie and have not played the games. So I, of course, went back and reread it after seeing the movie. And it's a great piece, and it makes me like the movie a little bit more.
Oh, thank you, buddy.
But go ahead and talk about why you sort of chose this movie to talk about.
Yeah, I've been pushing for your guest to do a show on this, you know, forever. And it's kind of one of those things where I always bring it up and it's like, oh, no bite on that one. Okay, all right, we'll move on to something else. But I always have been a big defender of this movie. I've never been a huge gamer, but when I was a kid, I loved the late 90s survival horror games, the Resident Evils and the Silent Hills and stuff. And I was always disappointed by the apologies to our friend Heather Wixon, but I've always been really disappointed by Resident Evil movies. Because the Resident Evil games have such a sort of rich storyline to draw from. They're very cinematic, and there's a lot of ways you can go with them. And the movies just sort of throw all that out, with the exception of sort of some characters in name only kind of deals. But this movie takes the best elements from the first two games, including the soundtrack, by the way. I don't know, we'll probably talk about that, but the soundtrack comes right from the games. And makes a really interesting narrative out of it. They take the first game's plot, which is this guy Harry goes to Silent Hill because his daughter goes missing and stuff, and well, it's sort of the same kind of deal where they're going to Silent Hill. There's the accident, the daughter leaves, and he goes into Silent Hill to try to find her. And then they do a gender swap there, which we'll talk about, I guess. But they also incorporate creatures and some other elements that are memorable from the second game. The nurses are one, and then Pyramid Head, the big giant guy with the giant machete who he drags around. Those elements come from the second game, and they change the context of the creatures a little bit. And we can talk about that later on, but I've just always been a fan of this movie because it does something interesting with a property that was already interesting without necessarily just repeating or being slavishly loyal or slavishly faithful to, you know, it's not sometimes when you see movies that are based on games or books, it's a transcription almost. Like, you're just, oh, this is what they did in the books, so here's what they do in the movie. This movie, you can tell that Christoph Gans is a fan of the and Roger Avery, who wrote it, are fans of the games, because there are visual cues and visual references to the games, but they also make enough of their own narrative out of it that it's just really fun. And I've always, you know, I saw it in the theater, and then I've always come back to it, and kind of, you know, a couple of my friends and I, we've kind of always been recommending it to people. It's kind of one of those movies that, you know, no one really talks about a lot, but I feel is really underrated, because I think, you know, as I wrote in my piece, I also think it's doing something really interesting with gender, especially in the context of horror. And I'm a huge fan of it. I mean, I've got a whole list of problems I have with it, but we'll talk about that. But this was your first time seeing it. So what's the verdict?
Well, it's slightly undecided, to be honest, because for most of the movie, I was not into it. And by the time it ended, sort of what it was about, or the fact that it was even about anything, started to come into focus a little bit. And so I actually need to sit with it a little bit so I can sort of reflect on the whole first half to two thirds of the movie and say, oh, okay, here's sort of what was going on during that section where I just felt lost. And I was like, oh, is this because I didn't play the game? I am just, because it just drops you in the middle of a story, sort of. It kind of gives you a premise where it's like, this girl sleepwalks and then she disappears. And then this lady goes to find her. And then it's a ghost town. And then and it's like, what? I mean, I understand the beats if you are familiar with the game, but that's what it felt like it to me. And I had no idea if this was true or not, but it did to me feel like a transcription. I didn't even know at the time that the main character in the game was male until I like went and read the Wikipedia entry. So I just assumed it was kind of a one-to-one thing, and I just felt so lost and had a real hard time giving a shit. It always looked great. There's a ton of atmosphere, and there are plenty of striking and memorable images. I think it's a well-made movie. I'm not positive it's a well-written movie. But I do need to like sit with it a little bit. I struggle, and I'm probably jumping ahead, but I struggle a little bit with the extent to which we are made to just sit through an exposition dump where it's like, we're not going to tell you what's going on for 75 minutes. And then we're going to spend 10 minutes straight flashing back and explaining everything. And then we'll get to the climax. And I was like, so this movie's not about anything until it tells you what it's about. And then you can catch up to the end. So I have some issues with the actual storytelling structure. Thematically, I agree that it's kind of interesting. And again, your piece helped put a lot of that into focus for me. So I'm very mixed right now.
That's okay. And I also want to throw out there that I'm totally with you on the writing. I mean, every time they do that exposition dump in the end, where she goes through the door and the bright lights come up and it's just like, now a little girl's going to tell you what's happening in this movie.
Good Lord.
I always laugh because it is just fucking ridiculous. Like it's so, but by the time, like, I'm angry about that as I'm watching it. But then once it goes to the sepia tone, you know, 16 millimeter footage, you know, fakery, but like, and then you do the flashbacks and girls narrating it, I'm so involved in that I forgive it. And there has to be a fair amount of it that is just, I mean, I just, because I am a fan of the games, I am familiar with them. There's so much that gets filled in for me anyway. But so I can understand why it makes more sense to me. But this time I was watching it, you know, I was watching it through your eyes, basically, because, you know, I knew we were going to talk about it. So this is a movie I've seen 10, 12 times and I'm watching it. Yeah, I'm a big fan of this movie. I really am. With all its problems, I'm a big fan of it. And it absolutely takes a good 35 minutes to get cooking, really, at all, if not more. You know, it goes out of its way to include, you know, some iconography from the games, which, you know, the little things like the girl's school is a big part, and the encounter that she has with the weird armless latex guy that spits venom and stuff like that, that's pulled directly out of, you know, like the games. Like, so there's like little things that, you know, as you said, are sort of they're kind of for us, you know, because we like the games, and they absolutely slow the story down. And then the other major problem with the storytelling, which you probably read too, which is that the whole subplot with Sean Bean was basically forced on them by the studio. They had to go back and rewrite it because the studio said there wasn't enough men in the movie. which, you know, did they understand the movie they were making? But
no.
And absolutely. I mean, whenever they cut back to Sean Bean, I was like, come on, like, let's can we move on, please? I mean, he does a couple, the director does a couple interesting things with it. Those are the times where the movie is most showy in its cinematography. You know, like there's that scene where she's running down the side of the hall, or excuse me, outside the wall, the facade of the building. And in the real world, he's standing there and she kind of runs through him. And there's that moment where, you know, he stops and goes like, oh, Rose, I feel you. I'm like, come on. Stop it. Stop it. But so he shows off a little bit there. But I, for whatever reason, and you know, you know how this is. Sometimes we forgive, you know, for budgetary reasons, creative reasons, and studio reasons. Sometimes we forgive the faults of certain movies that we love because we're like, well, you know, they did the best they could with what they were being forced to do. So I absolutely agree. I mean, much of the dialogue is like completely inane. And like there's a wonderful moment where after the two female leads are attacked by these like horrifying creatures, they walk out toward the hotel and they go, you know, I always heard this place is haunted. And the other one goes, I think they might be right. You just killed like zombie cockroaches, yeah, like with your bare hands. Yeah. But I still, if we're just, you know, sort of in my opening statement here, I love the production design of this movie. And like you said, like there are some killer like visual elements, and there are times when the CGI is showing and there's that bad, you know, like you can just feel the budget. And this was not a cheap movie. I mean, they spent $50 million on this movie. But there are definitely times where the CGI is bad, but there's so many, what I think anyway, really great practical effects in this movie. And set design, they there's a lot of detail here that, again, I'm thinking of, you know, no offense to people who like the Resident Evil movies, but like there's so much throwaway in video game horror adaptation type movies like that. You know, like it could be so easy to kind of to cheat around it. I feel so much love for the subject matter in this that, between the set design and some of the other elements, I'm in. I mean, I'm in for it. So I forgive so much about this movie because I'm just, you know, I'm in.
I've always sort of suspected, maybe based on some of the marketing, based on the way that I've heard people talk about it, that this is at least the video game movie. I don't know if it's the video game movie, but it might be, that aspires to be art, and that so many video game adaptations are just like, hey, remember that game? Well, now we're going to do it as a movie. Come see it. You'll recognize these characters. And they're just not any. I mean, I'm thinking of like Rampage from earlier this year. We could go on and on about how many sort of unsuccessful video game adaptations there are. And this one I admire does, as you said, it has production design and atmosphere, and it aspires to be art. And it is a sort of a very artsy horror film. And I found myself going back and forth during that whole section where I was lost, because I was sort of cynically angry that I felt out of place, because I thought, well, this is just because I haven't played the video game. And so then I was mad because I'm like, why should I need to play a game to understand what's happening in this movie?
Absolutely.
At the same time, when it does then turn into, you know, I'm not crazy about the sepia flashbacks and the girl narrating, and like when it does turn into just, we're going to tell you everything that's going on and we're going to throw a lot of like names and events at you, and just lines like, she's the good part of, like, what are you fucking talking about? Right, exactly. So shit like that. That stuff doesn't work for me. And then I found myself saying like, well, no, just be, have the courage to just be enigmatic then. You know, if the first half of your movie is going to be like, I'm not sure what's going on, who are these people, what are they trying to do? I don't know, have the courage to just be that the entire way through. I almost wish that it had been sort of more inscrutable and been more of sort of an art film, the video game as art film. I don't know. I you know, again, I'm kicking all this around in my head right now. And you mentioned the CG. I try not to hold that against movies, but sometimes it is hard because, as you said, there's some stuff in the movie that looks great because it's done practically. And then there are images that should be incredibly striking and effective and aren't, because I found myself pulled out by the bad CG. And I'm thinking specifically of, I guess we can spoil Silent Hill. So spoilers for Silent Hill, if you've never seen it, I'm thinking specifically of the fate of Alice Krieg.
Yes.
Where it's an incredibly disturbing a thought and a striking image that, to me, is sort of completely undercut by the execution of the CG.
a lot of the, according to the lore of the filmmaking, a lot of that in the church at the end was last minute. And so because they couldn't afford the, allegedly they wanted multiple Pyramid Head characters to come in and do the massacre, but they had to go another way. So you imagine, okay, well, now we have a time crunch with the CGI budget. But I absolutely agree. And I mean, the Alice Krieg to me is my MVP of this movie. Like, I think she is so great as Christabella in that over the top, big way. Like, yeah. I think she gets what movie she's in. And that image, you know, at the end, as you're referring to, of her, you know, her death scene, is absolutely undercut by the CGI. There's little things that, like, there's some, so what's so funny is that sometimes I think I'm seeing CGI and sometimes I'm not. Like, there's the moment where the girls are trapped in the boiler room and the blade comes through the wall, comes through the door, and he's kind of the Pyramid Head character is kind of just, you know, stabbing his blade, and there are so many shots where I'm like, oh, that's clearly a CGI blade. But I was watching some of the behind the feature stuff, and they did do a practical blade. I mean, there wasn't a blade on set doing that. So sometimes I go back and forth on it, but depending on how it's executed. But yeah, I agree. There's a ton of times where the CGI just, it really does undercut. It undercuts so much. And I think that it's a shame, especially because of how much work was clearly put into the production design otherwise.
Right. The subplot stuff that you had brought up, like, I do think it's interesting in terms of what it ultimately says about some of the themes of the movie. Right. And that's something that you call out. If you guys haven't read this piece at fthismovie.com, just go there and find Rob's piece on Silent Hill, because it's really great. I think it eventually kind of speaks to the themes of the movie, but I think it's a lot of shoe leather to make that point, you know. And again, the filmmakers' hands were tied. They were told to put more men in the movie, which is just so fucked up. But it's death, you know. Anytime they're on screen, I'm just like, I don't care. Nope. Somehow you're boring me with a Kim Coates performance, and I didn't even know that was possible. I mean, he's a lunatic anytime he shows up, and you're like, well, something's going to happen. This guy's on screen. He's just dangerous all the time. Oh, what? No, he's just another boring man in this movie about boring men.
Which maybe is like a metatextual commentary. I'm not even really sure.
I don't think it is, you know. I think it almost, and maybe I'm not giving the filmmakers enough credit, but I almost feel like the stuff that we eventually extract from that subplot may have even happened accidentally, you know, because ultimately they're inserting it in there in such a way, you know, that okay, it's happening in a different, you know, it's happening in the real world, and Silent Hill is happening in this other world, this other dimension, whatever you want to call it. It's structured that way not to make a point about, you know, what men can't see, basically, but about, you know, it's like, well, they need their own storyline, and we can't at this point involve them in the A story. So let's have them in a version of the movie where they don't see what's going on and they have no idea and they just wander around looking for stuff. So I think their story was determined by, again, the fact that it was sort of this addition that being forced upon them, and not a creative choice that was made to sort of underscore some of the ideas in the movie. And again, does that matter? No. If we're subscribing to this whole death of the author thing, it's right. It's what we pull out of it, not what they intended. But because it's not what they intended, I think there's not enough there to justify what we pull out of it. You know, it's like, it's just spinning its wheels when they're on screen. And, you know, for a movie that's like over 2 hours, this movie should not have been over 2 hours. I have no problem with a version of this movie, the fan edit, that cuts all of that shit out and just tells the Rada Mitchell, Laurie Holden story. Like, I am fine with that.
Yeah, I'm in on that too, because there's nothing, none of the exposition that's revealed through the Sean Bean character. Like, you have an exposition dump at the end of this movie. Just put it there. Like, you're not, and as you said, it's not interested in exploring any of the gender stuff or the, you know, the, I mean, a little bit, but not enough that really it justifies it. Yeah. And I mean, we could talk about the ending of the movie, which is actually one of the few cases in which, you know, you talked before about, you know, wishing the movie was a bit more arty and more ambiguous. And that's one of the times where I think the movie felt comfortable doing that. But yeah, I mean, it just slows everything down. Every time it's just, I mean, especially this time, because I was watching it more, you know, as I said, I was watching it kind of preparing myself, steeling myself to have to kind of defend it, practical magic style. Hey, Allie, what's up? that I was like, you know, kind of going like, all right, like my notes are full of like, yeah, you're right, I know, but
yeah. But so, as I was watching it and I'm like, oh, this movie's not clicking for me, I literally was getting a sick feeling in my stomach because I'm like, oh great, now the second episode in a row where I have to be this asshole. It's like,
no,
what? I don't get it. Why do you like this? And I'm not at all saying why do you like this. I'm just trying to figure out whether it works for me or not, not making you defend why it works for you. But yeah, I felt bad about not loving it because, you know, you want to love it.
Yeah. No. So let me ask you, just like in terms of the thematic stuff, like I when I wrote that piece, I was very much focusing on this idea of, you know, largely, you know, if we're cutting out the Sean Bean stuff, you know, like largely, you know, almost all female cast, like, yeah, very much a story focused on that. And especially considering that the games, as I said before, and as we talked about, because the protagonist of the first game is this guy Harry Mason, and there was a lot of fan outrage, of course, because, you know, the world is what it is, when it was revealed that he wasn't going to be the character and it was going to be a mother instead. And then a lot of the context of the, like, for example, I wrote this in my piece, the Pyramid Head character is sort of is symbolic of sexual frustration. So there's the whole thing in Silent Hill 2, which I don't think I'm not really sure how many people have even looked at it, but if you haven't played Silent Hill 2, at the very least, like, watch a Let's Play video of it or something, because it's remarkable storytelling. No, I'm gonna stick to my guns on this one, because it is really, really, really great. And it's about, you know, in that game, this guy James Sunderland goes to Silent Hill because his wife wrote him a letter saying that she was going to meet him there, and the only problem is that his wife has been dead for 3 years. So it's this thing of, he goes there to try to discover, it's a place they used to go, and they're recounting memories, and basically as he's there, all the creatures are representations of his guilt and anxiety over her illness and death. So, like, the nurses are sort of, you know, they're all sort of, you know, cleavaged out and skirted out and stuff. And so they're sort of representative of sexual frustration. And Pyramid Head obviously has this big phallic weapon, and he's kind of this oppressive force. So anyway, so my point with that is that in the games, those creatures are contextualized as sort of like aspects of male guilt, and they're very male sexuality coded, male gaze kind of thing, or male anxiety. But in the movie, I took another meaning out of it because the character is female, the lead character is female. So the Pyramid Head, to me, takes on this whole other thematic role where, you know, he's invasive and penetrative and stuff like that. And it's almost like he almost makes a better antagonist for this story.
Yeah.
So it's another reason why I really like that they actually took, I mean, they weren't going to make a, and this is for Silent Hill fans, but they weren't going to make a Silent Hill movie without Pyramid Head. He's the most iconic character in the series.
Didn't he replace Slash in Guns N' Roses?
He did. Okay. His guitar was 12 feet long, and okay, it wasn't practical. but the way they use him here, I think, is really, you know, effective. And also the speaking of images, the Colin character, the janitor with the barbed wire.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, that whole thing to me is, I mean, some of the more striking images in the movie too. And I love that scene of him crawling out of the stall. I actually do think is a nice mix of CGI and practical production design. But anyway, so the context of the characters, the antagonist characters, and the fact that the men are trapped on the other side of the world really is, you know, because to me, this movie is a mother's odyssey into hell to save her daughter, you know?
Right.
And I really, really like the way they played each of these elements, in a way that, again, they didn't have to, you know, they didn't have to be that careful with it. And I really do think that, I mean, it gets a little complex when you get to the Christabel stuff with the witches, burn the witches and all that, but that, I mean, that goes right on top of that same thematic stuff anyway. So,
yeah, I really respect that they tried to make it about something, you know, instead of just, you recognize this property, you enjoy the game, let's make a movie out of it. That they actually tried to make it about something. Two things. Oh, one, you'd mentioned the janitor character, his name is Colin, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Okay, so I was like, when you said Colin, I was like, I don't know who the fuck that is, because if you call anyone by their name in this movie, I don't know who it is.
That's okay.
I read the Wikipedia summary after I watched the movie because I was like, I want to make sure that I got what was happening in this movie. And goddamn, my eyes glazed over. It was like reading a fantasy book. I was just like, there's just so many names. And I'm like, I don't know who these – and it's all on who wrote the Wikipedia summary. It is not a reflection of the movie at all. Whoever wrote the Wikipedia summary was very thorough, I guess, and just I couldn't get through it. I was like, you lost me, and I just watched this. Like, I'm completely confused about what happened in this movie. I just saw it. So the controversy was completely off my radar in 2006, maybe because, again, I wasn't a gamer, maybe because I was interneting less. I don't know. But so I was surprised to hear you even say that, because just before you said it, I was thinking about, oh, my God, can you imagine if they made this movie in 2018 where it's like, yeah, hey, video game guys, you know that game that you're obsessed with that's all about a man? This movie is entirely about women now. And not only does it feature all female characters, but it is specifically about being a woman. I mean, truly, like, the actual internet would have just melted down.
Absolutely. Absolutely agree. This movie got in just under the wire.
That's so fucking sad. Then we all just accept that. We're all just like, yeah, that's how it would be now. Man, that sucks. Okay, moving on. I don't know what to do about it, but like,
yeah,
it's just it's a another reason accepted reality, and I don't understand it.
It's another reason why I think this movie is special, though, because it got away with it in a time before, you know, it wouldn't have been able to get away with it. But it's fucking sad. It really is. But let me ask you this. How is the Kim Coates character there 30 years ago and also the same age 30 years later?
I don't know.
It's always bothered me in this movie. I don't get it. But
it makes no goddamn sense.
Except
to say that Kim Coates is immortal. He's a Highlander, which I've always suspected, and this movie confirms.
He might be.
Yeah.
What do you think about – I wanted to ask you this as a horror lover. What did you think of the – well, we're spoiling things.
Yes.
What did you think of the skin rip on the steps of the church?
Yeah. No, it's fucked up.
Yeah? Fucked up, right?
There's some stuff in here that's fucked up. The fate of the Laurie Holden character is very upsetting.
It's really, really upsetting, too, because she's a character – I mean, she's pulled right out of the game, but like, she is – I really like Laurie Holden in this. I'm not a huge Walking Dead person, but I know, you know, she's on there, right? She's a Walking Dead person.
Well, she was.
Okay.
Yeah.
She was. Spoilers.
That's, you could say that of almost anyone who's ever been on The Walking Dead.
Because overall, I mean, I like this movie, but there's hella stiff acting in this movie. I mean, it's not every performance is a winner. But Alex Krieg is great, and I think Laurie Holden is really good, too. And her death scene is really upsetting. Like, really upsetting. I was thinking... Sorry, go ahead.
No, just I really liked her in this movie and didn't want to see that happen to her. And I will say that, again, I was sort of annoyed when she shows up because I could just feel like she was a transplant from the video game. Oh, this character is here and sort of dressed this way because, well, that's how they are in the game. And it just felt like that was literally – that could have been the plot reason why she was dropped into this. How did I get here? I don't know. Ooh, I came from the video game. So that bothered me, but I thought she was really, really good, and not that she's ever not good. Actually, I just watched her in Pie Wacket, and she's really good in that. But, you know, she tended to divide people on The Walking Dead, which had more to do with her character than her performance. But I feel like she's an actor who doesn't get enough credit and doesn't get enough parts that show what she can do. And I thought she took a part that was sort of designed to not show what she could do and turned it into something.
Yeah.
And she was way more interesting to me than the Rhoda Mitchell character, which, you know, no offense to Rhoda Mitchell, but I was so much more compelled by anything having to do with Laurie Holden.
Sure. And there's a nice thing in there I was thinking about, and in terms of the kind of intersectionality with the gender stuff in there, because, like, you know, she's a police officer. And, you know, lots of times police officers are coded masculine, you know, and there's this whole thing about mother is God in the eyes of a child and the idea of being a mother. And I really like that the Rhoda Mitchell character is an adopted mother, and she kind of has to sort of fight for legitimacy, even among other women in Silent Hill. Yeah. About, like, you know, like she says, like, you know, She's adopted, but I'm her mother. You know, there's that thing where it's and LaLaurie Holden character says to her, you know, she's lucky to have you. And gradually over the course of the movie, as you said, the LaLaurie Holden character gets on her side, you know, to where she's a very staunch defender. And there's a moment that really struck me this time, because for years and years I've been saying that one of the things I really hate about the movie is there's the scene where the Roddy Mitchell character is going to go down into the hospital, which is another iconic setting from the game. But I think it works really well here because it's a descent down the elevator. And it's this descent, as I said, down into hell. And she's standing there memorizing the map while the Christabel and her followers are kind of prepping everybody for the journey. And there's a moment where the Laurie Holder character it's assumed that they're both going to go down there. But once the Christabella character, and again, I'm really sorry, the cult leader lady character the cult leader.
That one I at least am like, oh, Alice Creek. Okay.
Alice Creek. Yeah. When she discovers that, you know, the girl in the locket and all that bullshit, Laurie Holden pulls the thing from the elevator doors and sends Roddy Mitchell down by herself.
Yeah.
And to me, I always thought about it as like, it's fucking bullshit. That's a plot convenience. Like, that's because they wanted to separate them. And, you know, it's her sacrifice is meaningless. It makes no sense. Why wouldn't you just go down with her? There's nothing you're going to do except get your ass kicked and eventually die, which is, you know, functional for the plot, but doesn't make sense for the story. But this time when I was watching it, there's a moment where she's watching Roddy Mitchell count the steps and the turns and all that stuff. And then she kind of walks over to the elevator and she looks in the elevator and kind of gives it a once over on the inside and kind of makes a face and kind of goes back to the rest of the people. And that gave me pause for a minute because I was like, oh, maybe this is actually an effective character moment. That's actually her bailing on a mission that she was never going to go on anyway. And this might be really super inside baseball for those of you who had seen Silent Hill 16 times the way I have, but just chew on it a little bit. Maybe there is that whole within the sort of female experience, the difference between being a woman and being a mother. And maybe the Laurie Holden character was not necessarily as compelled to go down there or understood that she couldn't handle it the way that the Roddy Mitchell character has to be forced to, and that only a mother could go down there and do that. And I'm reading into it a lot because I like this movie, but like, I thought of that this time. And again, having seen the movie a bunch of times going, oh, I never picked up on that before. And it's a thing that always bothered me, but now I might have a reason for it because again, within this world of women, there are all these different types of mothers and good mothers and bad mothers and adopted and birth mothers and all that. And the way the sort of patriarchal kind of paternalistic religious aspects play into it, there's a lot of shame and all that stuff. But I really like that moment now that I picked up on that little detail. Just something to look out for next time. And you can disagree with me in the comments if you want. But I think that I actually think that that moment is on purpose more than I used to. So, again, it's one of those movies that I keep getting little bits out of because I'm, you know, an crazy person who likes it.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly just read it as the sort of cliche self-sacrifice, but also, the idea that, like, she can go to a point or that she recognizes that Roddy Mitchell's quest sort of supersedes her own, right? That reuniting her with her daughter is more important than whatever Laurie Holden has to do, and she's going to do whatever she can to make sure that that happens. And I didn't necessarily read it as Laurie Holden being sort of less than, which I know is not exactly what you're saying, but
not quite. Yeah.
There's a little bit of an implication of that like only a mother could do this.
Different kinds of strength. I think, think that she felt by staying there and being the guardian, you know, that was what she could do in that scenario. Okay. I'm absolutely not trying to disparage.
Like, I know you're not. I know you're not at all. I'm just talking about what the movie would be saying.
I gotcha. Yeah.
According to, you know, sort of that reading. No, I know you're not saying like anyone who doesn't have kids is a nothing.
Yeah.
No, that's really interesting. Again, I appreciate that, you know, the potential exists for any of this inside this movie. And clearly I need to watch it again, even though I'm not dying to revisit it right now. I don't know.
You gotta let your brain calm down a little bit.
I guess. Yeah.
I'll send you character flashcards so you can just make sure you get the names
for
next
time. Yeah, that might help. None of the sort of Deborah Kerr Unger stuff really works for me. Like, just her appearance in the story, and I know she serves a very important function in terms of the plot, but none of her every time she shows up, I'm like, I should be more excited. You're Deborah Kerr Unger, and you look all fucked up. But I just found myself kind of checking out, having to, you know, when it came to that kind of stuff, which I shouldn't, because again, that's sort of central to the movie.
But she's written around. Like, I agree with you that she's kind of not, she's functional, but she's not interesting. Definitely.
Right. She just kind of shows up to, like a video game, where it's like, yeah, now we go to a cutscene where this character is going to show up and give you some information.
Right.
And then you go on your next little mission, you know, and that's kind of what it felt like.
It's like a fetch quest. Like, I need this thing. Go get it for me and bring it back. And, oh, she's gone when you bring it back
right,
to her.
Right, exactly.
I guess I'll hold it. Oh, look, it fits in the door. Like, it gets me to the next spot.
Exactly.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you there.
All right.
So what do we think, I guess not to skip ahead, but like what do you think about, put it this way, the ambiguity of the ending? Do you feel like that's a cheat, or do you feel like it's earned enough to be interesting?
I think it's earned enough to be interesting, because again, I think enough of the movie had been ambiguous to that point where it's not out of step. And I also think it's very much in keeping with everything that came before it. So what aspect of it do you think might be a cheat, or that could be perceived as a cheat?
It's just always been very divisive among people who are, you know, because I've kind of I keep in touch with the movie and the conversation around the movie for the last—
Are you running the Silent Hill movie message boards?
Earlier when you were like, the guy who wrote the Wikipedia, or the, well, you know, the person—
It was you.
And I was sitting there thinking to myself, don't cry. They're just words. They're just feelings. No, it's not me. But I've definitely read it a number of times. But no, it's very divisive because, you know, it is kind of the movie brings up this idea of two alternate realities and doesn't, you know, do a lot with it until the end. But no, I'm with it. I like the ending in the movie, especially considering the context of adopted parents trying to understand their child, or any parents trying to understand their child, and the two, you know, the Sean Bean character kind of being more of the, well, let's institutionalize her, and Roddy Mitchell's character being more of the, no, I want to go with her. Let's, you know, I want to understand her. I want her to see this through to a conclusion. So going with her through that odyssey and then not ever being able to come back the same person. I mean, even like from a Joseph Campbell standpoint, where, you know, you come back changed, you know, I think there is a nice element to that where he will always be on the outside of her and the daughter's experiences, sort of permanently. They totally fucked that all up in the sequel, which I won't even bring up or encourage you to watch because it's garbage. But there's a weird retconning in the sequel that totally shits all over it. But
what,
we won't.
Tell me what it is, because I'm never going to watch the sequel.
It's just essentially, so the sequel tries to do Silent Hill 3, in which the Alessa character, or the what's her name, Sharon character, is grown up and living with the dad, who is the Harry Mason character, who, oh, God damn it, Patrick, you're going to make me do this. Okay. So, because I could just, I'm not even there. I can see your eyes glazing over.
Yes.
It's so embarrassing. So the Sean Bean character in the sequel, if I remember correctly, essentially takes over, even though it might be an alias, takes over the character who was supposed to be in the game, the main character of the first movie. That's about as far as I'll go with it. So they kind of retcon it a little bit. He gets killed off, and the girl discovers that it's like a different
Sean
cult.
Bean gets killed off?
Sean Bean gets killed off, okay. And then...
I mean, that, I guess, goes without saying.
Sure, right, obviously.
It's Sean Bean.
It's Sean Bean. Doesn't die in this movie.
No, you're right.
But yeah, no, it all gets all messed up, so I won't even go into it. But I really like it as just, you know, for me, I just divorce myself from the sequel and just think of it as a really interesting ending that goes thematically with what the movie's been doing.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, the fact that the movie ends in a church, like this final showdown with like Satan, or no, right, or as she says obnoxiously, I have many names. Yes. Kill me. But I like that. I like that into that and out of it again, and not being able to come back, or coming back changed, essentially, which I think is, you know, she now understands her daughter. She's now, you know, on her daughter's level, and her daughter is on her level. And again, so much of the movie is about being a mother, and I really, really appreciate that.
I mean, weirdly enough, had the movie ended with them returning to our reality and reuniting with Sean Bean in that sort of sterile home, I think
no
it
one
would
lives
have
there.
Felt wrong emotionally. Like, I don't know that this movie can have a traditional happy ending, which isn't to say that the ending is sad, because at least Radha Mitchell is reunited with her daughter. But I think tonally and emotionally, it's the only choice, because I think going the other way would have been like, huh? What? This doesn't feel right, given what has just happened. We just saw Alice Krieg split in two from the vagina and Lori Holden burned alive. what else?
Still
is there anything
else
about Silent Hill that you want to say?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's a lot of, you know, a lot of my notes are just kind of the same stuff. Yeah, I mean, we could talk about we sort of briefly brought up the whole witch element, but I don't know that the movie is necessarily, you know, since we're talking about witches the last couple weeks, I don't necessarily know that the movie does anything different or interesting enough outside of what we've already mentioned, to really get into it. I do want to mention that the Silent Hills design, both I believe the game and the movie are both heavily based on the ghost town of Centralia in Pennsylvania. Okay. Which is not too far from where I am. Famous ghost town. I haven't. My best friend did a couple years back, and
what
he sent me pictures.
What kind of a fan are you?
You know, I'm too busy writing the Wikipedia page, Patrick. People keep going in and telling me it's too long, and I need to clean it up and fix it. So, you know, travel budget time has kind of been lower.
You're still maintaining the Angel Fire site.
GeoCities. I'm not a monster. I have a bunch of notes about how what David Lynch would have done with this movie, but that's all speculative bullshit.
Was he supposed to do the movie?
No, I just, you know, I want David Lynch to do it in every movie. Right? So. Yeah, little things like that. Just, you know, Rose's dress changing from blue to red over the course of the movie reminded me of Die Hard. And not too much. Just again, you know, we talk about movies that we know are, you know, maybe not altogether there and have problems and issues. But for whatever reason in this movie, the problems that it has are intriguing enough to me. And so much of the movie is done with so much love and care that, you know, I embrace it for all its faults. And I think it has a great, you know, a lot of great messages, even if they're not superbly written, you know, in the way that we would like to, in the smoothest way. But again, when you digest it over and over and over again, the chronology of the story delivery doesn't necessarily stick with your brain as much as what the movie was saying overall. So it kind of blends together in a soup kind of deal. Silent soup. Yeah, where you're not so frustrated by, oh my God, like, why did they wait till now to tell me this? But, you know, once you know it and you go back into it, you say, you know, I think this movie is doing a lot of really good things. And again, it's a shame that, you know, it is far too long. I mean, even when I popped the disc in, I was like, oh my God, Silent Hill's 2 hours? Like, why is Silent Hill 2 hours? But no, I'm all out there for adaptations that are done with care. Too often we remake and adapt things and kind of just, as I said before, like, we're stenographers, and, you know, this movie falls into that a little bit, but there's enough memorable stuff and creative stuff in it that I just think it's worth defending. So I hope that I've done a good job of that. I'm not really sure, but
yeah, no, you have. I really appreciate the fact that, like, you're kind of a fan of this movie and speaking out on this movie's behalf, because it wasn't really on my radar when it came out. I didn't go see it because I was like, well, I never played the game and I've been burned by so many video game adaptations. Why am I going to go see this? And over the years, I've heard people mention it whenever the conversation is like, what is the best video game adaptation? A lot of people will say, like, I don't know, maybe Silent Hill, which is when I started to get suspect that, like, oh, it's a, at least it tries to be a movie. I'm glad to have seen it. And, you know, what you just said is exactly what I was very poorly trying to express at the beginning of the conversation, which is, now that I know what I know, I need to go through and see the movie again, you know? And so, I won't be frustrated for the first 75 minutes by not understanding what's going on, because I'll have just a better idea. And I think I can appreciate certain things about the movie a little bit better. So I do need to watch it a second time. It probably won't be today or this October.
Next scary movie.
This is completely off topic, but you just mentioned, you know, remakes and reboots and sequels. Just this past week, the trailer for the remake of Pet Sematary was released. Did you happen to watch the trailer?
I have not yet.
It is directed by Dennis Widmeyer and Kevin Kolsch, who made Starry Eyes, which was my favorite horror movie the year it came out. I love that movie. I have a great deal of respect and faith in these filmmakers. And I'm only looking at a trailer, so maybe it just has everything to do with the way the movie is marketed, and I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. I'm not trying to determine a movie's quality based on a trailer. But I was surprised by the response that I saw online, which was like, man, this looks great. Oh, yeah. Because to me, it looks like, why are we remaking Pet Sematary? You know, well, you've added kids in creepy masks. But other than that, it looks like the movie that was made, only, you know, updated for 2018. And again, it may be a completely different movie. It may be a great movie. I may love it to pieces. I hope I do. But it's just one of those things where at a certain point, do we just need to retell every story because enough time has passed?
I mean, there's all kinds of schools of thought on that. And, you know, I think there is an argument to be made that you know, every great piece of art should be remade every, you know, 25, 30 years. But yeah, it's such a strange line between like the give the people what they want versus do something different. And, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking of the Halloween trailer of 2018, and I haven't seen it yet. I'm sure it's great. I have all kinds of faith in the people who made it. And but people were saying like the trailer is like blowing me away. I'm like, I mean, yeah, it looks cool, but it looks like a Halloween trailer. Like,
And actually, it looks a lot like the Rob Zombie Halloween that you all hate.
Yeah, exactly. Because it wasn't, well, we can get at it later. But it looks like a Halloween trailer because it gives you the thing that you want, you know. And right. And again, I haven't seen the movie. I'm rooting for that movie. I want to see it. I think it looks, I have all the faith in the world, just like you were saying with Pet Sematary. I hope I love it. But let's not pretend like, you know, we have to be honest with ourselves sometimes and say, is this the thing? You know, we're having this with Star Wars now where it's like endless. But is this the thing I want because it's the thing I'm familiar with, or am I actually interested in someone doing something different with this thing that I love?
Right, which, you know, goes back to Silent Hill, where it's like, who is the movie for? Is it for the people that played the game, or is it for people who have never seen the game? And I would argue, having only seen the movie once, that it plays a lot better for people who know the game. I would agree that by the end it does go somewhere and it does say something that makes it stand on its own as a movie. You know, I think it wants to be a movie. I think it wants to tell a complete story, you know, that is kind of removed from other outside influences. So you don't necessarily have to know stuff in order so that you can take things out of the movie. But I think there's a lot of stuff. Again, even the inclusion of the Laurie Holden character or the way she's introduced, all of it just feels like it's dropped out of the sky by a developer, you know, who's like, and put this in there and put this in there and put this in there. But it's not just simple fan service. It's not just, you guys like Silent Hill. Here's a bunch of the stuff you like in Silent Hill, but we put it in a movie. And I appreciate that at least.
It does something, as we said, something challenging and interesting with the material. And by the way, if I throw this out there for Silent Hill gamer people, the idea of the siren going off before the darkness comes,
yeah,
is not something that's from those games at all. That was imported into the movie probably to weed out some plot things, but they've actually since imported that into the games.
Oh.
So, you know, I mean, I haven't really played too many of them past the first three, but I do know that they've kind of imported that into some of the newer games. So, you know, someone somewhere must be a fan of this. You know, someone, they must have thought this was a good idea.
Well, and also I'm so unfamiliar with the game that I keep forgetting that they completely changed the genders, that this right. became a story about a woman instead of a story about a man. Because when I watch it, I'm like, oh, I assume that the protagonist of Silent Hill, the video game, is a woman who looks kind of like Rada Mitchell, because I'm equating it probably with Resident Evil. Right.
Yes.
And so I'm forgetting that like one of the very first things they did was throw out a pretty key piece of the game Silent Hill, which is who is the protagonist. And they threw that out and they completely changed it. So I'm not giving them, I think, enough credit right off the bat for wanting to do something different and sort of distinguish themselves.
Which I think is the goal of, you know, it's why we're here to begin with, right? It's why we're talking about these we're talking about this stuff at all. So yeah, I hope that even if you aren't familiar with Silent Hill, you know, the game or the movie, got something out of this, to listen to it. And I hope that if you haven't seen it, you check it out, because I really, really, I respect this movie and I like it a lot and I keep coming back to it.
All right. Well, thank you guys very much for listening. Thank you, Rob, for, sort of opening my eyes to some things in this movie. I like it better after talking to you about it, which is always, you know, a sign of a good conversation.
Awesome. Thank you, buddy.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you guys for listening. Please keep watching scary movies. Keep participating in the 7-word reviews, the scary movie challenge. I don't know why my brain is shot. I don't know what it is. I guess it's October and I'm trying to do too much.
The 7 scary words movie challenge.
Right. You know, do the thing that we're doing with the words and the scary.
Christabella, Rose.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Dahlia.
Sharon is the leftover good part. No, she's the good parts of Sharon. She's the, what is the line?
She's the good that's left over from Alessa.
Okay.
Alessa
is the dark. Sharon the dark is the good of... that's left over from Alessa. Jesus. Anyway, thank you guys for listening. We will talk to you soon.
Why did they take your daughter?